from Hanselminutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 13, recorded Monday, April 10th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Codesmith Tools, makers of Codesmith, an extensible template-based code generator for .NET. And you can get $100 off with coupon code HM100 just for listening to Hansel Minutes. Online at codesmithtools.com. Support is also provided by peterbloom.com. Start with better controls, finish with better sites. Online at peterblum.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks about the tools and techniques he used to discover a Trojan that had infected his web server.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and welcome back to Hansel Minutes. I'm here with Scott Hanselman, of course. Hi, Scott.
How are you, sir?
The topic this week, CSI, your computer.
Forensic analysis on your machine.
Quincy for the PC.
For our international crowd, of course, Jack Klugman, in the reference to Quincy MD, was a medical detective show about he worked in a morgue where he was a medical examiner.
Yeah, and he always went over the boss's head. Yeah. So this is about tools that you can use to diagnose problems with your PC, not necessarily code problems, but just everyday problems.
This was a really weird week for me when it came to debugging and odd behavior on my system. We had a ASP.NET worker process running at 100% for no particular reason at all.
Hmm.
We had a Trojan horse, kind of evil malware virus.
Yeah.
I blogged about the Trojan at shrinkster.com/DVX. And the debugging the ASP.NET worker process at shrinkster.com/DVV. Both of them involved going into the toolbox. And interestingly, the toolbox consists more and more of anything that sysinternals has ever done.
Huh.
I used to have a whole pile of utilities, and more, I just keep coming back to those guys because they get you right down to what's happening underneath your system. I used to say that with .NET, everyone said, oh, it's taking you to a new layer of abstraction, right? It's a whole new level of abstraction.
Right.
And I always joke that it's really just managed spackle over the underlying OS. And I say that, you know, somebody somewhere has to call load library. You know,
right.
It doesn't matter whether you're using Java or whether you're using .NET. Somebody had to load that such and such a DLL into such and such EXE.
Yeah.
And inevitably, the level of debugging that I end up getting to is the ports and processes, DLLs, and which DLL got loaded kind of level. I think there's kind of two levels of debugging out there. Maybe you would agree. There's like, you know, your hardcore debugger, you know, hardware debugger, soft ice, kind of attached to it, find out what entry points were relocated at what point in memory, symbols,
likes
server
to,
path type
likes
stuff.
To read the CPU registers for fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. And we all learned that in school. And, you know, there was a time when I could say, oh, man, dude, he was moving zero into AX, dude. And that's totally. And he jumped, you know, and he went off into the weeds. And, you know, frankly, I think it's difficult to be a really awesome kernel level debugger.
Well, it depends what you're debugging. If you're debugging the kernel, great.
Yeah. And, you know, I've always said be a Swiss Army knife. Do as much as you can. But I reach my limit when I get into this kind of stuff. And I do not claim to know this like I used to. Back in the day, man, I could thunk with the best of them, you know, Windows 16-bit.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I defer to the experts. And, you know, the experts right now really keeps coming back to Mark Rusinovich at Sysinternals. He's actually speaking at TechEd. At a pre-con at shrinkster.com/DVI. And he's going to be doing a pre-con on debugging and fighting malware with advanced detection and removal techniques.
Wow, cool.
Which is going to be rockin' sweet. He's going to talk about, I'm sure, his rootkit stuff that he did with that Sony CD recently.
Right.
And different kinds of malware. So my very cursory write-up of fighting that Trojan at shrinkster.com/DVX, not nearly as interesting as the stuff that he's going to talk about. But even though his exploits are awesome, I like reading them, and I struggle to understand them all, I still think that there's a basic level of understanding that I think we can all use to debug, you know, 80%, 90% of what goes wrong in the average .NET developer's life.
And now, is this knowledge that will transfer over to non-programmer types? Or do you really sort of have to be a geek to get this week's show?
Well, right there, you imply that a non-programmer type can't be a geek. And certainly there are lots of folks that don't program, you know, IT guys that may listen to this podcast and others that are not necessarily .NET programmers. But yeah, I think that this is a geek person type of a thing. You know, if you like the task manager, if you leave the task manager running all the time, you might be a geek, right? You know, if you sort by CPU, if you sort by virtual memory size, you might be a geek.
I think there's a comedy routine in this somewhere.
Very, very likely.
Well, okay. What's next?
So in the comments of my recent post at shrinkster.com/DVP, a debugger better than I, whose name I cannot quite pronounce, looks like Matthias van der Fluten, made a comment on some of my screenshots that the function that I thought was causing trouble in this particular issue with ASP.NET Worker process going to 100% was not, in fact, the function I thought it was. He looked at the offset and said, well, I don't think the function is that large. And I think what's happening is that you're seeing the nearest exported function, and you need to load the symbols. And I had completely forgotten about symbol servers. When you use a tool like Process Explorer from SysInternals, it is the task manager on steroids. You can get that at shrinkster.com/DVM. You can right-click on a process and hit Properties. And then from the Properties dialog box, you see things like the path, like where did that process get loaded from? Because just because you see foo.exe doesn't mean it's the one you think it is. It could have been loaded from a different directory. But you can click on the Threads tab, and you can see the functions that are doing the work.
Cool.
And it turned out that I was just looking at kind of the raw information there and not seeing truly what was going on. So I made some assumptions. So he pointed out, well, you can download the Microsoft debugger tools, and you can get details on this at shrinkster.com/DVW. And this is a really interesting support article at Microsoft.com. And the only support article I've ever seen that includes embedded video. So it gives you an idea of how complicated this is. It's actually a KB article at support.microsoft with an embedded streaming media demonstration of how to do this. This is setting up a symbol server. Microsoft has got a global server at Microsoft.com that you can set up a path, an environment variable, machine-wide on your system, and point it to a local folder. And you'll see all the details there when you visit the link. So I've set this up, and I just made a folder in my system called C/symbols. Hmm. So then when a debugger, whether it be Visual Studio, whether it be WinDebug, WinDBG that comes with the Visual Studio tools and the SDK, or Process Explorer itself, decides to get more information about a Microsoft executable that you're trying to debug, they'll automatically download the symbols.
Now, that means that you have to be plugged into that server. I mean, it doesn't work for everything, right?
So this particular symbol server works for Microsoft symbols.
So anything that comes with Windows, anything that's part of the OS will
be available there. So I've set that up, and I'm looking at my symbols folder right now, and I see a directory called ASP.NET Worker Process .pdb.
No kidding. That is cool.
And inside that is the PDBs for ASP.NET.
So you actually will be able to pull those up in Visual Studio and walk through the code?
You can't walk through the code. We're talking about symbols. So this will help you get call stacks where you couldn't see call stacks before.
Okay.
It'll give you, you know, for the most part, not quite a line number, but it'll tell you where functions are blowing up.
Okay.
I'll post about this in the future.
I always thought the PDB files contained enough information to reconstruct the source code for .NET applications anyway.
They contain information about up to and sometimes not including line numbering, but I'm sure one of our listeners will correct me and give me the exact details.
Okay.
I'll put up a before and after screenshot of debugging the ASP.NET Worker process with the symbols and without them.
Sweet.
And we'll see how much more information that you can see.
Okay.
It also will allow you to take, like, when you get a dump file, like a DMP, when your system is blue screened, you can load that into Process Explorer or Debug View, and you might be able to get some information about whereabouts that happened. That might be as simple as getting the information about a driver that you couldn't see before.
Yeah, that's been a big problem for me.
Now, you can set this up machine-wide. There's an environment variable called ntSymbolPath that you can learn about at that URL, shrinkster.com/dvw. You can set it up at a solution-by-solution basis inside of Visual Studio. There's a debug symbol files. Search these paths. And then enterprises can set up symbol servers for themselves. Like, we have a very large application called Voyager here at Corellian, and there's a number of different versions. So we have an internal symbol server so that when someone's running a particular version of Voyager, they can set their environment variable to our main symbol server, and it'll find the right versions of the PDBs for that particular version of Voyager.
Cool. That's very cool.
Yeah. And there's so much more there than I even claim to understand now that we're in such a mixed, unmanaged, managed kind of world. But dealing with PDBs like this is a particularly complicated issue, and having a symbol server, as Matthias pointed out to me, would have given me even more information. And even though I solved the problem, I didn't truly understand what was going on until I started digging into that.
You know, I think one thing this is prompting me to do is to set up the symbol server and just write some code and throw some exceptions and see, you know, just mess around with it. Grab a stiff cup of coffee and just start playing with it.
You know, and another thing about PDBs that has always caused me a lot of trouble is this issue with PDBs and the GAC, you know, loading stuff into the GAC.
You know, let's pause there for just a second, and let me ask you, now, you're a web developer.
Sure.
And you obviously have talked about putting things in the GAC before. I've always been under the impression, and maybe it's just because it's more of a Windows developer than a web developer, but that, you know, loading things into the GAC can, you know, just cause more problems, I guess, because of versioning and stuff and updating.
Well, for us, it's not about the copying around of the files. There is something to be said for having an xcopy deployment, being able to just take an entire bin folder of your ASP.NET application and just dump stuff over there.
Right.
For us, it became an issue around interop. We have a bunch of COM DLLs that get used, and if you just go into Visual Studio and say add reference and then pick a COM DLL. If you've got foo.dll, it's a COM DLL, and you pick it out of the add reference, you'll automatically get an interop assembly generated for you. They'll automatically run that TLB imp and they'll make an interop for you. But if you're doing anything funky with COM, marshaling of custom types or arrays or variants, sometimes you want to write these interop assemblies yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, you want to mark them as being what's called a PIA or a primary interop assembly.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you need to strongly name that. Mm. And those often become shared because COM DLLs are registered system-wide.
And they're shared, right.
So then the associated .NET interop DLL, it's nice to mark that as being shared. And those often go into the GAC.
I guess that makes sense.
So I think of the GAC as being the place where system-wide things go.
Right.
Things that are shared amongst many, many websites on a single web server.
Yeah.
Secret management, things like that. Maybe a database access layer that a number of different applications are going to use. Once you get things in the GAC, though, people feel that the GAC is this strange place. And like we talked about last week, you can, you know, subst a drive to the GAC and see what's really going on in there.
Right.
One of the things that people forget, though, is that if you have the DLL in your local directory and in the GAC, it'll get loaded out of that local directory, and that can be confusing about where things get loaded from. And often, you want to put the PDB files in the GAC.
All right. Now, I may be remembering this wrong, but it was my assumption that, at least in .NET 1.0, the loader looks in the GAC first before looking in the local directory, and then we'll look at your config file to see if you've redirected it. But I thought the GAC took precedence over being local.
So it's a little tricky, and you can take a look at Richard Grimes' excellent discussion of the GAC that he's got up at shrinkster.com/DW0. And it depends on how you loaded the assembly. If you asked for a fully qualified assembly name, if you said, I want this assembly with this public key token in this version, it'll come out of the GAC.
Okay.
If you ask for it by the short name,
right,
then it'll come out of the local directory because the GAC doesn't know, and it's just saying, I want the foo, you know, assembly.load foo isn't enough information.
That's true. You could have multiple versions in the GAC. That's true.
And he's got to, so which one would it pick?
Right.
Well, if it finds it local, it'll pick the local one.
Okay, good point.
Now, and all this is very complicated stuff. Fusion debugging is a huge hassle, but understanding the Fusion debug stuff is actually a big part of some of this basic debugging that we're talking about. I like to keep Fusion running all the time. On my system, I've got a C:\FusionLogs. Travis Illig has got a great Fusion log viewer settings changer that you can get at shrinkster.com/DW1 in the pre.NET 2.0 world. It's pretty complicated to set this kind of stuff up. He'll edit the registry. And what happens is you'll get in your Fusion logs folder a list of all of the different attempts to load a .NET assembly and those failures. So if you're feeling like a DLL isn't getting loaded or the right version isn't getting loaded, you can go there and check that out. But kind of back to the point of these sysinternals tools as it relates to what got loaded. We've talked in the past about .NET 2.0 applications loading up the wrong version of DLLs.
Right.
When I loaded .NET 2.0, Outlook had some add-ins that were .NET managed add-ins.
Right.
And suddenly I was getting 2.0 loaded instead of 1.0 and things were breaking.
Yeah.
I talked about that at shrinkster.com/DVK. Process Explorer, again, is a great tool where you can load up Process Explorer, look in the lower view. You say view, lower pane view, and say what DLLs are being loaded and from where.
Hmm.
And if you take a look at that Shrinkster URL I said about shrinkster.com/DVK, you can say, well, I insist that this particular version of the SDK be loaded in memory, the CLR rather. We talked about that a little bit. Yeah, last week when we were mentioning shell extensions, only one version of the CLR per process.
Right.
So what's going to happen in the shell extension world when there's 2-3 versions of the CLR out there? It's become a real problem.
Okay.
Both FileMon and RegMon and TCP View, those kind of three together, I'm finding more and more useful when I'm having a situation where what exactly is this application doing? Is it writing to the disk? Is it looking in the registry? And both FileMon and RegMon at shrinkster.com/DVG and shrinkster.com/DVT, respectively, will allow filtering. So I can say, well, I want to see what the carlfranklin.exe is doing in both the registry and to the file system at runtime. So while this might not be something you'd want to use to debug what DLLs are getting loaded, although they would show up as being accessed on the file system, it'll show you, is this application looking for a particular key in the registry?
Hmm.
And last week when I was having a heck of a time debugging my my ThinkPad's wireless card, I had the feeling that there was an application that was going into some of the wireless registry settings and changing them. And I used RegMon to take a look at that.
You had a feeling?
Wait, don't you just have a gut where it's like, well, where could it be getting this information? And this is the thing I was talking about. A lot of this kind of root cause analysis when you're not interested in going at that really deep level of debugging, like that Rusanovich level of debugging,
yeah,
is there's only so many places that these things can be finding their information from.
Right.
Sometimes I feel like people are debugging an application and they go, and then a miracle happens and, you know. And it's like,
Larson methodology.
Right, exactly. Someone says, well, I click here, and then all this stuff that I'm completely glossing over happens.
Right.
We talked about that when we were talking about debugging the XML serializer.
Correct, yeah.
Windows is not that much of a black box. You can see inside the processes. You can see what threads are running in what DLLs and inside of what process. You can see with symbol servers a little bit more insight to what's going on. There are debuggers that provide you this value. But even the most basic stuff, like this Trojan issue I had, where I needed to find out which process was talking to this particular server. I found that there was a win logon process, had a DLL loaded inside it, and it was trying to send email from a Russian website.
No kidding.
Well, we had Ethereal, the open source packet sniffer,
yeah,
on the wire. And we could see that someone's trying to talk SMTP off to this Russian machine.
Hmm.
But the guys that were doing this debugging forgot that you want to resolve that connection to a particular executable. So we just followed the path. We said TCP view from, again, TCP view is shrinkster.com/DVS. You can say resolve endpoints. We could see that some mail.ru was being opened by winlogon. We said, well, winlogon, that seems like a reasonable thing. That doesn't sound evil. Mm-hmm. We know that we need winlogon. That's the NT login
right.
manager.
Right.
So then we loaded up Process Explorer. we sorted by company name in this particular case, and we said, wow, that's not, you know, that's a blank company name. It was a random 8-character generated DLL.
Ah.
Okay, that doesn't look right.
Nope.
So then we went into the Windows folder and found that DLL. We saw that it had been updated a few days before. So that DLL has appeared out of nowhere a couple of days ago. We looked inside the thing with a hex viewer. We didn't see any nasty strings. But it clearly didn't look right. Searched for it on Google. Didn't find any, which meant 8-character random generated thing.
Right.
Did a search on Google for 8-character generated, you know, DLL. WinLog on, and then found a bunch of malware applications that like to do that. So how does this DLL get loaded in memory? Well, where else could you look? So we look in the registry. We look in the registry. We search for the name of that DLL. We can see in the registry under the WinLog on section deep in the bowels, there's a place where all the different things that want to load in to WinLog on put themselves. We could have seen that had we used auto runs, the tool that lets you see all of the things that happen at startup at SysInternals. But I just poked around in the registry, removed that, poked around. I mean, the whole thing's listed up on my blog. The point is, though, that you have to be able to follow that, you know, one
follow the path.
Follow the path from the connection that was open back to the process and the process to the DLL. Because there are places that you can hide things. People have said on my blog and have informed me that, you know, there are now kernel mode evil malware applications that don't show up in Task Manager at all, that don't show up inside of things like Process Explorer. And I think that we'll see at the TechEd presentation that Mark will talk a lot about that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it's hard to hide stuff if you know where to look, you know?
And Vista is going to make that much easier, of course, with security being enforced at the kernel level.
Yeah, theoretically, although if you've ran the recent builds of Vista, it constantly prompts you, is it okay to do this? Is it okay to do that?
Yeah.
You run a control panel, says, are you okay to do that?
Right.
We found a really great website a lot of people recommended by a woman named Tess who works for Microsoft at shrinkster.com/DVQ. She's an expert debugger and she works for the PSS product support services group at Microsoft. And she posts the most interesting, got this crazy dump file and got and found out that it was this. You know, it was the garbage collector or it was a block thread or whatever. shrinkster.com/DVQ.
I love the name of her blog. If broken it is, fix it you should.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, a professional debugger. It's definitely kind of tales from the debugger side. And I'm enjoying that. And I'm going to need to take a debugger class because the last time I did this kind of lower level debugging was really back in the soft ice kind of just when we were switching into protected mode. So I'm out of practice.
Wow.
There's a number of tools that you can use. SysInternals are just kind of some of them. The same thing applies to ASP.NET kind of level debugging. We've talked before about tools like Fiddler, shrinkster.com/DVF, and IE, HTTP headers at shrinkster.com/DVE. These are all tools that let you see what's going on at the HTTP level. Frankly, I find the ASP.NET kind of debugging to be the easiest because you can really see what's going on. I mean, there's no secret discussion happening between your browser and the server.
Right.
It's all right there. Whether it be AJAX or cookies, you can see all that traffic.
So is there an end to your Trojan horse story? Or, you know, how did it end?
Well, we dug around a little bit more, and there also was a browser helper object, like a toolbar that was hiding inside of IE.
Ah.
And it would go back and forth with this WinLogon and apparently, it was emailing itself around. So the WinLogon stuff was the bit of the Trojan that would email itself to other people via these Russian mail relayers. And then the browser helper object would listen to IE and then occasionally pop up porn ads while surfing. We think it was a Trojan Vundo, V-U-N-D-O variant, but not quite sure. I tried a number of different malware tools and no one would detect it. So There probably is one that would detect it, but I think that it just was some variant that the new stuff hadn't figured out.
Okay.
A number of good comments happened though on that particular post. Folks recommended tools like Spyware Doctor to try to look at it, but you know you can't even trust the spyware tools anymore.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they themselves are spyware. Myself, I use Spybot. I trust them.
Yep.
Interestingly, Windows Defender, I don't think found this one, and I'm not quite sure what I'm thinking about the Windows Defender tool quite
so is
yet.
That Microsoft Anti-Spyware, the sequel?
Right. Windows Defender is the next generation of Windows anti-spyware, the stuff that they bought from the giant corporation. And okay. Windows Defender will be also built into Vista.
Okay, good.
And actually, speaking of kind of defending type things, you know that the Google toolbar was revved this week.
No, I didn't know that.
Interestingly, if you go to Tools Extensions and say Find Updates, for some reason it's not showing up yet as an official update on Firefox. But if you go to toolbar.google.com or shrinkster.com/DVL, it includes anti-phishing, which is very cool because I've got my parents using Firefox, as I'm sure all of the listeners have their family and friends using Firefox.
Yeah,
but
I
still worry about phishing. And this will actually bring up a nice fat pop-up saying that, you know, I am suspicious of this website. Think twice before giving your PayPal password away. And then you had seen something. Was it projectip.com?
Yeah, projectip.com. This isn't really phishing or anything, but it's just opened my eyes to something we knew was there, but it can be exploited. This is the clipboard can be read. The default setting in IE6 is that a server can read the contents of your clipboard. And usually, you know, you don't really think about that too much, but a lot of people copy their credit card numbers from some file they have somewhere safe and sound on their computer and then paste it into, you know, Amazon.com or wherever they're ordering stuff from when they need to order. I'm not one of those people who has my credit card memorized. So, and, you know, if you do that and then you don't immediately copy something else into the clipboard, there's a chance that whoever's looking at your, you know, whoever's processing your order can or something else, or not just that, cross-site script, for example, some JavaScript code could read the contents of your clipboard. So, you know, you go to another site after that, it's still in your clipboard, they can read it.
Yeah, that's definitely something to watch out for. And actually, speaking of security, you were talking about some people keep information in text files, maybe they shouldn't. One thing you might want to take a look at is if you are running a tool like Windows Desktop Search or Google Desktop, type in your social security number in your desktop search, type in your credit card number, see if that exists somewhere on your system that you maybe have forgotten about.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I found our social security numbers in a PDF that I had created of our taxes years ago and forgotten about, and then used the search tool to find that bit of text and basically wiped our system of social security numbers, credit card numbers, things like that.
Great idea if you're going to upgrade a computer and toss out a hard drive, right?
Well, if you're going to toss out a hard drive, you need to burn the hard drive.
Yeah. I mean, nobody does that, of course. And I have all my old hard drives. I don't know what to do with them. But other than subjecting them to severe electromagnetic impulses, I'm not sure how to do that. So, I mean, there are companies out there that make these hard drive shredders. We've talked about them on Mondays sort of as a gag because, you know, they're $40,000, $50,000. Some of them are just nothing more than magnets, but there are also machines that will turn your hard drives into a pile of gravel.
Well, if you're going to be donating your hard drive or giving it to a friend, or if you've just got hard drives lying around, now that it's so easy to plug a hard drive into a system or plug it into a USB disk temporarily, there's a tool called Derek's Boot and Nuke at shrinkster.com/DW3. You can get a floppy version for older systems and a CDR version for newer ones. It's very dangerous, but it's a self-contained boot system that wipes the hard drive of your machine.
Wow, that's great.
So you just boot off of it. There's even one for the Mac. It'll do SATA drives. If you're tossing a disk, just make one of these CDs. Label it very clearly because you would hate to have someone boot off this and make a mistake.
Well, now, does this go down as far as the sectors and remove the binary information from the sectors of the drive? Because I know that's the problem. You can use OnTrack software and that kind of stuff to retrieve files that have been lost by reading the underlying data.
If you could take a look at the FAQ on Derek's Boot and Nuke site, he talks about secure deletion of data from magnetic memory.
Okay.
Talking about, you know, what they have to do to flip the bits, the different methods. You know, you can read the FAQ and decide whether you think that this is something that you'd want to do.
So he's doing some smart things, messing around with a FAT table. And
no, he's wiping it. He's actually going, all right, let's lay down ones and let's lay down zeros We'll do it 100 times. But he says in there, are you sure it works great? No. But it is very well thought of, and it's certainly cheaper than buying one.
Okay. Good deal. You know, I think we might have an offshoot of this, maybe with Camtasia, called Stump Scott. You know, where you could sort of remote assist into somebody's computer and try to uncover.
We could do live debugging of right. someone's problem.
Try to uncover a problem and see how long it takes you, you know, and if you can be stumped.
Well, I'm very sure I can be stumped. I am only as smart as the sum of my blog readers, and I consistently am impressed with the level of folks that are goodly enough to read my blog, and I consistently learn from the commenters, particularly whoever comments first, you know, whoever the first guy is to stand up and go, BS!
Yeah.
It works like this.
Right.
And I appreciate that. Just
sure.
like in this debugging issue, I had completely forgotten about symbol servers and I've immediately configured my system, and that'll be the first thing I'll do now when I start using a dev system is get that symbol server started up.
Absolutely. Your ego is not your friend, folks.
Yeah,
destroy
definitely.
It.
Egoless programming is the way to go.
Exactly. All right, until next week, Scott, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your expertise, and we'll see you next week on Hanselmanets.